All right, we're ready for chapters 13 and 14 of Deuteronomy. This is the outline we're following. Borrowing from Wiersbe, we are in the second major section, the second sermon, if you will, as Moses is working his way through his three or four sermons, as you choose to look at that. This is Moses looking within. He's looking at the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments, and we distinguished what little distinction there is between those in our last study. We won't go back through that. We are in this section here, in the statutes, dealing more with some of the regulations of the law, like the clean and unclean animals we have of chapter 14. So we'll get to that here in just a moment. Let's review our chapters of where we've been. Chapter 1, first sermon was starting with a review from Sinai to Kadesh. Then he continues that review, chapter 2. All right, yes, the wilderness wanderings and the victory over Sihon, which obviously, most likely, if we're not familiar with Deuteronomy, but we're familiar with history, we would assume chapter 3 would be victory over Og, because they go together. The division of the land and Moses forbidden to enter. He ends his first sermon with what message? Yeah, necessity of obedience. That's the first sermon. So he starts the next sermon on the note of 10 commandments. This is the law, and the people fear God. Chapter 6 kind of broadens the view. What does he say? Yeah, the place and the warning and the meaning of the law. Here's what the law is all about. It kind of broadens a view from chapter 5. Chapter 7, you are a separate people. We'll see that in our study tonight. Chapter 8, keeping the commandments. Same thing we saw in chapter 4. Chapter 9, warning against pride and self-righteousness. When you cross over and you conquer the land, it's not because you're great, because you're righteous. It's because those people are wicked, because God's with you. That's the point. Chapter 10, mercy and obedience. 11, last time. Yeah, here we're going back to that same theme again that we've seen in chapter 4, chapter 8. We see it again in chapter 11. Chapter 12. All right, worship as God directs. Talks about the place that God chooses. Now let's stop and talk about chapter 12 just briefly, because it sets the pace for a couple of things that we need to talk about in our study tonight. In chapter 12, he talks about the place that God chooses. The place is never named. Why? There was multiple places. It ends up being, for the most part, with the tabernacle, it being located at Shiloh. And then, ultimately, the temple is going to be established in Jerusalem. So why didn't he just mention Jerusalem? Because Shiloh is going to be the place of worship for a while. Why didn't he mention Shiloh? Because Jerusalem later is going to be. Wherever God chooses, that's the place where you're going to worship. And so we're going to see that place mentioned tonight in our study. At the end of chapter 12, while we're talking about chapter 12, notice at verse 29 through verse 32, that was the ending section of chapter 12, there was the warning, as he talks about the place where God directs, you're not going to follow after idolatrous worship. You're not to, and so don't try to be like the heathens, and don't try to be like the idolaters. Don't inquire how they worship. They'll become a snare to you. The Lord hates idolatry. And so you need to be careful at verse 32. Part of that carefulness, branching off, is what chapter 13 is about. So let's go to question one. What's chapter 13 about? All right. Yeah, here's those that lead you to idolatry. So here are influences. He had just warned them about the influence of idolatry. You get into the land, you're going to have idolatry all around you. You're going to need to drive them out and get rid of them. But his focus here is not so much on the idolaters themselves that may influence you. He's already talked about that. Here he's talking about some influences that may lead you to the idolatry that's in the land. It may be the false prophets. It might be those who secretly entice you within the family and friends. And then there may be cities that are given over to idolatry. And so here's how you're going to address those problems. So here's the destruction of those that would lead you to idolatry. So this is an additional note from what we've seen so far. What do I mean by an additional note? We hadn't seen much about this. We may have had this hinted at, but we haven't seen this thought developed like it's developed here in chapter 13. Here's what I mean. Previously, he's talked about going in and driving out the idolaters and driving those people out and destroying all their images, and don't inquire how they did that. Don't try to imitate them. Get rid of all of that. But this goes a step further. This may come from among the people of God, who are supposed to be the people of God, maybe is a better way of wording that. So here's the warning about those people. Does that make sense? All right. Let's get underway with chapter 13 now. Three things happen. First of all is the false prophets. And so let's talk about these false prophets that are mentioned here. And so if you're so disposed to make some notes, you might want to make some marginal notes of some passages that we're going to flag here in a moment. He said chapter 13 now. He said, if there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign and a wonder. Now, this sounds kind of strange on the surface. This shouldn't surprise us if we're familiar with Exodus. We'll get to that in a moment. Look at verse 2. Here's verse 1 and 2 talks about, even if he uses signs, and the sign or the wonder comes to pass, of which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them. So in other words, a false prophet may come along, and he may try to encourage you, let's go after these gods that you haven't known. Now, this could be a false prophet rising among the people. That often happened. But it could be a false prophet from among the pagans trying to influence you and telling you, let's go serve these other gods that you've never known. And let me give you evidence that I'm speaking the truth here. And so he works a sign, and the sign comes to pass, and he's a dreamer. That is, he claims to be a prophet, and he foretells the future, and it comes to pass. Well, could that happen? Well, several commentators observe quite often people who predict the future sometimes will get it right. That's true, isn't it? For example, someone may claim to be a prophet and foretell who's going to be the next president. And he may hit it, because that's not really too hard to guess if you kind of know the environment where things are going and what your prediction is. So you get it right. That doesn't mean he's a true prophet. Let's stop and talk about these signs just for a moment. Were there times that false prophets could do something that looked like a sign or even work a sign? Well, let's take the Egyptian magicians. Did they not work signs? For the most part, the early stages of the plagues, without going back and enumerating every one of those, there were times that Moses and Aaron would work a sign, and then here the magicians would do what? Repeat the same thing. Well, it looks like they've got the same power. Do you think they had the same power? I don't think so. Well, let's look at a couple of passages may help us. This is where I said you might want to flag a passage or two. Let's go over to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. So what I'm trying to give you is evidence that sometimes false prophets could work a sign, and I'm going to put sign in quotations because at times that may have been a sleight of the hand or it looked like power, but there were other times when they may have been using power from Satan. And so I'm not going to deny that there were not extraordinary powers that they had. So let's go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and start at verse, chapter 2, I'm sorry. Did I give you the wrong chapter? Anyway, starting at verse 9, 2 Thessalonians 2 beginning at verse 9. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power. What's the next word there? Signs and lying wonders. Now look at verse 10. With all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. God would send them strong delusion. So God allows at times Satan to perform some power that would delude and deceive. Did God cause that? No. I have no evidence that God causes that. God allows things like that. We're going to see why in a moment. So let's just save that thought. I'm just trying to drive home, there are evidences. I'm citing, first of all, the magicians of Egypt. Secondly, this passage, there were signs and wonders that were wrought by Satan. All right, let's look at another passage that may help us with that. Let's go to Matthew chapter 24 and in verse 24. There would be some false prophets that would rise. This was in the day of the destruction of Jerusalem. False prophets, false Christ, and false prophets will arise. So we know they're false. God says they're false. And if we believe in the one true living God, God's saying these are false. Okay, they're false then. They will arise and they're going to show something. They're going to show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. In other words, these are pretty impressive signs. So the point here is, could there be a false prophet that uses signs? And I put that in quotations here because at times, I think it's a broad term, can encompass a deception where there really wasn't a sign. And then it could be some power by Satan that is an extraordinary power. So how are they going to know whether this is a false prophet or not? It's a pretty simple point that I'm about to drive to in it. Bingo. They've already received the revelation of God that has been confirmed by the miracles, wonders, and signs of God. And what these false prophets are saying is direct contradiction to what they have already had confirmed for them. Does that make sense? So here is something already confirmed by miracles and wonders and signs of God. They know it is. And then here is something contrary to that. The emphasis in this text is not on the signs, it's on the message they speak. Does that make sense? That's where the emphasis is. Now, verse 3 and 4, or verse 3, he said, don't listen to him, to the words of that prophet, the dreamer of dreams. And verse 3 is also, and I should have it verse 3 and 4, what's God doing with this? Not God causing it. He's testing. How does God test them with this? All right. Do you see the distinction in God causing something and God allowing it? God allows temptation. He allows Satan to tempt us. Does God cause us to be tempted? If he does, that contradicts James chapter 1. God doesn't tempt any man. So I know God doesn't cause it, but God allows things he doesn't cause. God can allow this deception, and that becomes a test. Are we going to believe? Are we going to accept the truth that we already know? Or are we going to be led away by the deception? Now, whether or not you love God with all your heart. So now verse 4. Here's one of our verses that we, in answer to question number whatever it is, on the fear of God. Is there anything, question number 8, is there anything in these chapters about the fear of God? We'll summarize later what they are. Here's your first verse in our study tonight. In verse 4, you shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice and hold fast to him. What do you learn from that? About fear. All right. If you fear God, you're going to obey him and you're not going to be led away and you're not going to be deceived. And so you walk after the Lord your God and you fear him. I'm learning fear means you walk after God, you keep his commandments, you hold fast to him. Do you see the contextual definition of what fear means? What it encompasses? What it does? All right, now verse 5, to finish that section, what is to be done with that prophet? All right, he's to be put to death. Because he's spoken. Now notice this at verse 5. He has spoken in order to turn you away from the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to entice you from the way the Lord your God commanded you to walk. Here's the evidence. You've already been commanded. You already know what the truth is. And no matter what signs he may show you, you know it's not the truth. You know it's deception. So you're to put away that evil from your midst. Here's this influence needs to go. Make sense? So not only drive out the idolaters, here's a false prophet comes along pointing you toward idolatry. You get rid of him. Don't listen to him. All right, let's move on to the next section. And he talks about one who secretly entices you. Now, this is a powerful section for us, I think. There's a lot of application we can make of this. So let's look at verses 6 and 7. Here is someone who may secretly entice you. Do you see a difference here? The false prophet may be publicly teaching. That's real dangerous, isn't it? Equally as dangerous is someone who works secretly teaching. You see the point? Let's suppose a false teacher comes in and begins to permeate in the area. Maybe he comes to and worships with us. I don't mean he's a member, but he worships with us. And suppose he starts teaching premillennialism publicly. That's pretty dangerous. But it would be more dangerous, finish my sentence, if he were secretly and undercover working, teaching the same. And that's just as dangerous. And I'm learning that from this context. So look at verse 6 and 7. Who does he list as might be an influence? All these family members. Your brother, the son of your mother, the son of your daughter, the wife of your bosom, or your friend who is as dear as your own soul. I learned a lesson there, practical thing, footnoting. We can have friends that are as dear as our own soul. And it's interesting he doesn't mention father and mother. Some commentators observe that. Thought maybe they're an exception. I can't imagine them being an exception when your wife is identified and your children are identified. But if your parents were guilty, they're an exception to that. I just think they're just not mentioned for what that may be worth to you. Now, what do you learn from verses 6 and 7 about these close family, close kin? All right. Yeah, they may come to you and say, let us go serve. Look at the end of verse 6. Let us go serve the other gods that have not known, etc., of the gods of the people all around you and from one end of the earth to the other. Let's go do what everybody else is doing. Let's do what the crowd's doing. This is the popular thing. Let's go serve and let's worship those gods. We'll come back to that in just a moment. Let's look at verse 8a. He says, don't listen to them. I'm more interested, don't consent, in other words. But verses 8b through 11 gets a little harsh. What does it say? All right. Yeah, look at that at verse 8b. Your eyes shall not pity him, nor spare him or conceal him, but you're surely going to kill him, and your hand, first one against him, and then all others join in. I take it that this is going to be a public stoning. Led by leaders, you don't just take it on yourself. I'm going to stone him. We'll see more evidence of that perhaps as we go along. But you're not going to try to conceal them from others so that they're not punished. And so you have this brother that comes, you have a son that comes, you have your daughter that comes or your wife comes, and you're not to have any pity on them. You're not to conceal them or hide them from others. They are to be killed, and your hand is to be the first against them. So verse 10, they're going to be stoned until they, because why? Yeah, they sought to bring you away from the Lord your God. I learned a powerful lesson. God and our relationship to God is far more important than our relationship to the close kin. Father, mother, wife, son, daughter, you name it. Does that make sense? More about that in a moment. Look at verse 11. Here's our second passage. It talks about fear. When you stone them with stones and they die, what's going to happen to everybody else standing around seeing? They're going to hear that and they're going to fear. Here's our word. And not again do such wickedness as this among you. Do you think correcting a problem and everybody knowing that problem has been corrected has an impact on the rest? Absolutely. You might flag Acts 5:11, and I'll not develop that. You can take a look at that and figure out what that's about. Same principle is found in Acts 5 and verse 11. Now, here's something I learned from that section right there. I learned a very powerful, some commands of God are hard. I know that's so simple that you think, well, why did you even have to say? But I want you to think about it. There are some commands of God are hard. Nobody said doing what God said was always going to be easy. Can you imagine living in the day of Moses and you had a son or a daughter or a wife or a husband that secretly enticed you to go after idols, and you decided you wanted to do what was right, and you had to report that, knowing they're going to be stoned. And you lifted up the first stone. Some commands of God are hard. That's powerful. What else do you learn from that little section? Good point. This serves as a deterrent to sin. Kevin?
I said it teaches me how serious this is with God. He's jealous. He doesn't want any of us to go another way. It's his way.
Good point. I don't know if you've observed this. That's a real good point. If you've observed this or not, perhaps you have. But as a preacher, as an elder, the other elders will obviously identify having dealt with this. Sometimes when a family's got a child that is in sin, and if the elders want to talk to that child, that grown child who's a Christian, about their sin, not even talking about withdrawing it, we just want to talk to them about their sin, they'll quickly usher that child and go somewhere else to protect the child from the elders talking to them. Reckon what they'd have done in Moses' day, concealed them. Wouldn't they? There's some relationships. Let me rephrase that. Our relationships to our immediate family is not as important as our relationship to God. And if we stopped right there, our time's been well spent tonight. That's powerful, I want to tell you. All right, let's move on. Anything else you want to mention this from that little powerful section? Good point. Good point. Let's start at verse 12 and talk about the idolatrous cities. I take this that this probably is not your city. You may disagree, and if so, then go the direction you think the text is talking about. I think this is talking about not your own city, but you hear a report of another city. Once they get settled in the land, you're going to be in your tribe, and then you're going to be in your city, and you hear a report in another city. So be that as it may, let's look at verses 12 to 14. If you hear a report, what are you to do? Check and see if this report is true. So let's follow this now. If you hear of someone and one of your cities, which the Lord God gives you to dwell in, certain corrupt men have gone out from among you and enticed the inhabitants, saying, let us go and serve the other gods. Here's that influence again. Gods we have not known. Then you shall inquire and search out and ask diligently, and if indeed it's true and certain that such an abomination is committed among you, then here's what you're to do, and we'll pick that up at verse 15 in a moment. Now, a case in point, you might flag Joshua 22 as a case in point where this principle comes to play. Remember, when the Transjordan tribes, those 2.5 tribes, built an altar, the other tribes thought, and I'm paraphrasing just the principle, they thought they've erected some kind of something to another god and done something wrong, and they're ready to go do it. But they go and inquire and come to find out that's not what they were doing. They misunderstood. They're practicing the principle. You've heard a report, go check it out. Here's a practical thing. Don't ever get ready to execute some kind of judgment, be it your separation or your condemnation, until you've checked out what's going on. The report may not be true. It very well may be, but it may not be. All right, now verse 15 and 16, what happens? Yeah, the entire city is to be laid flat with the sword, destroying it, even their livestock completely destroyed. What do you do with the plunder? Yeah. And it's to be completely burned with fire, with all of its plunder, and it shall not be built again. In other words, this city is to be completely and utterly destroyed. Do you think the principle of verse 11 is going to come to play? just like when you executed this family member, and others are going to take heed. I kind of thought about enticing some people, but I think I'm going to think twice. You think that city that may be thinking of going into idolatry, letting their city be turned, they're going to think twice. And they still have a problem with idolatry, as severe as this is. And that's why they go into captivity. All right, now 17 and 18 to finish this section. What do we learn 17 and 18 now? If you do that, in other words, you deal with the false prophet that we talked about in the first few verses, and you deal with family members in the first few verses, and you deal with the city given to idolatry. Here are these three influences that may lead you to idolatry. You deal with that properly, what's going to happen? You're going to be very blessed. You're going to turn away the anger of the Lord, and he will show his mercy and have compassion. He'll multiply you as he swore to your fathers. Because, dropping down to verse 18, you listened to his voice, you kept his commandments, and you did what was right in his eyes. Now, let's reverse that. Let's suppose they don't deal with the prophet that way, and they don't deal with their family that way, and they don't deal with the cities that way. What's going to happen? What's implied? Yeah, they're going to be cursed. And that's exactly what happens. All right, let's go to chapter 14 now. What's chapter 14 about? Has to do with mourning, not mourning as in versus night, but mourning as in crying and weeping, and deals with unclean animals and tithing. So this is part of those statutes that we have enumerated as per our outline a moment ago. So three things that are connected, particularly the first section, verses 1 and 2, is connected with that idolatry, the idolatrous influence, heathen influence that we just talked about. And then we'll talk about some other regulations, unclean animals, and then the regulation with reference to tithing. All right, now let's flag some things here at verse 1. This is gets a little interesting to me. Perhaps it will to you as well. That you are the children of the Lord your God, you shall not cut yourselves or shave the front of your head for the dead. That was an idolatrous practice. And so let's flag some verses that may deal with that for what it may be worth to you. Seemingly, before we look at the verses, Kaufman observes, and I think he may be right in light of these references I'm about to, that it seemed to be connected with idolatry, where they would shave above their eyes, between their eyes, meaning right above their eyes, they'd shave a portion of their head so that it becomes clear and distinct. Anyone who sees them, they've shaved, and then they cut themselves somewhere and they bleed. And Kaufman observes that, and I think he may be right, that it was the idea of giving their blood and their hair, in other words, giving a sacrifice of themselves to their gods. I'll give you a case in point. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 18. Do you remember the contest at Mount Carmel? And where Elijah is ribbing them because they're, what's going on here? Have you cried out? Maybe they're gone on a journey. Maybe they're asleep. Remember that? All that contest. So as they're making their sacrifice to their God, look at verse 28. They cried aloud and they cut themselves as was their custom with knives and lances, and blood gushed out. In other words, they're not cutting themselves, just say, I want to do mutilation to myself. It's a sacrifice to their gods. Maybe our gods will listen if we cut ourselves and we give blood. And we cut our hair and we give something precious to our gods. Our gods will listen to us. Let's look at another reference along that line. Jeremiah 16 and in verse 6. Both small and great shall die in the land, and they shall not be buried, neither shall you lament for them. Cut themselves, nor make themselves bald. Make yourselves bald for them. Here is an allusion or reference to mourning, where you cut yourself and make yourself bald. Again, that sacrifice seemingly to their gods. Now, I'm not going to take the time to notice Leviticus 19 and verse 27 and Leviticus 21 and 5. But you get the principle in the practice. So that's not, there's nothing wrong with shaving part of the head or cutting some hair, but if it was connected with idolatry or gave the impression of idolatry, then that should not be done. Because, you tell me why, verse 2. You're a special people. You are a holy people. The Lord has chosen you to be a people to himself, a special treasure above all the peoples of the face of the earth. This is the nation through whom the Messiah is coming. And so you're different. Reminds me of chapter 7. You are a separate people, yes. You're a separate people, and therefore, so don't mourn like the heathens. You know, when there's a problem and there's a death in your family, you're not going to cut yourself and you're not going to shave your head, and because you're a different people. You don't act like the heathens. Don't develop their practices. Make sense? All right. Now let's talk about the clean and unclean animals. You might flag Leviticus chapter 11, because basically we have a repeat of Leviticus 11. Why does it need to be repeated? We already have Leviticus 11. All right, they need to be reminded, and this is a sermon of Moses. Yeah, it's been revealed, but he's taking that revelation and preaching it to them, isn't he? It's part of his sermon. And so he's reminding them of the requirements of Leviticus 11. So we're going to flag that over in just a moment. I'm not going to go through every detail of this, because we've already been through this in chapter 11. Of Leviticus, for what that may be worth to us. But what we have here are the distinction in clean and unclean animals. In other words, when you get across in the land, this wasn't just a law to memorize over here. We're going to put it in practice once we get across the river. We get on the other side of the Jordan River, we're going to put it to practice. So he talks about clean and unclean animals. So what's verses 3 to 8 about? Say again. All right, here's some forbidden animals. Don't eat those. So the animals, he said, these are the animals which you may eat, you, the ox and the sheep and the goat, etc. But you may eat of every animal with cloven hooves, having a hoof split into two parts, and choose the cud. However, there were some that you couldn't eat. Like what? The camel. And the hare, for they chew the cud, but do not have the cloven hoof, and these are unclean animals. That almost, verse 7 gives me a little pause, because you think of a camel having a divided hoof. So let's go back to Leviticus chapter 11 just for a moment. You may have a note there, and you may not have a note, but Leviticus 11 and 4 gives us a little more information. That you shall not eat among those who chew the cud and those who have cloven hooves. The camel, because it chews the cud but does not have a cloven hoof, it is unclean to you. Well, Pulpit makes an observation I think is quite interesting, that the camel's hoof parts, but it's not divided. There's a difference. That at the heel, it's one. So it does not have the same thing that is being discussed, what we think is being discussed in the context. Check Pulpit for what that may be worth. I think Pulpit, perhaps Cal and Date, let's get a little more detailed that we don't have time to go into. So anyway, here's just a repeat. Leviticus 11, for what it's worth to us, is a little more detailed. This is a summary. Does that make sense? What about the fish, 9 and 10? All right, and whatever does not have fins and scales, you may not eat, for it is unclean to you. So it's unclean not because the meat's bad for you. It's unclean because God labeled that as unclean. That's all they needed to know. God said, don't eat it. It's unclean. You can't eat of that. You'll become contaminated, not physically as much as spiritually. And then here's that which you can eat. So God has regulations or statutes. That's the section we're in. Then the birds. What do we know about the birds? 11 to 20. Say again. All right. And then let's get to verse 21. Now this gets a little more interesting. If an animal is already dead, dies of its own, in other words, you didn't kill it, you may not eat it, but you can, and that's probably because it, though it's not mentioned here, wasn't properly bled. But you could sell it or give it to a stranger. And then let's talk about this boiling the young goat in its mother's milk. We came across that at Exodus 23 and in verse 19. You might want to flag that verse. That may have reference to cruelty of animals, but more likely it refers to an idolatrous practice. Again, I reference Kaufman. He observes that the pagans used this this practice to increase the fertility of their crops. And they would take the life of the kid and the mother's milk and thought that doubled the fertility of their crops. So if they boiled the kid in its mother's milk, they're thinking they're making their crops double fertile. And so it was an idolatrous practice. Now, that may have had reference also to cruelty of animals, but I think it's in this context, don't do what the heathens do. Don't shave the front of your head, don't cut yourself, and don't boil the kid in the mother's milk. Don't do what the heathens do. Live different and distinct from them. Does that make sense? All right, let's talk about the tithing and the time we have left, and then we're going to look at some practical things. Hopefully we'll have time for that. Now, verse 22 and 23 tells us what? All right, here's what you're going to do with the grain and the produce that you have year by year, and you're going to take the tithe of your grain and of the new wine, your oil, and the firstlings of your herds, so of your crops and your flocks, you're going to take your percentage, your tithe, and you're going to take it where? Yeah, to the place which the Lord chooses. Reminds me of what chapter? Deuteronomy chapter. If it reminds me, it's going to have to be one before this. So we've got 14 chapters. Chapter 12, yes. The place where God chooses. Where is that? Well, it'll be Shiloh. It'll later be Jerusalem. So I had an outline that said to take your sacrifice to Jerusalem. But that's not what it's saying. It's saying take it to the place of worship. It will be Jerusalem later. It'll be Shiloh once they get settled in the land. All right. Now, here's our third passage on fear. What do you learn about fear at verse 23? It can be learned and must be learned. That you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. Come back to that a little bit later. All right. Now, if the journey's too long, maybe once the place of worship is set up, it's down here at Jerusalem, and you're up here near Dan or Issachar somewhere. What are you going to do? Change it to money. In other words, sell the flock or sell that tithe of the flock or that tithe of the grain, and you're going to convert it to money. Then what are you going to do with the money? You're going to use that tithe and go buy, according to verse 26, whatever your heart desires, and make, not just anything, but an oxen or sheep or wine or similar drink or strong drink as the, I'll come back to that in a second, whatever your heart desires, and partake of that in the use of your tithe. In other words, you're still giving it to the Lord. Does that make sense? Now let's stop and talk about the King James right here at verse 26. The wine or strong drink, some have made a distinction between that sometimes wine is one thing and wine is unfermented, and then strong drink is fermented. That's not the distinction here. That's true. It can be. But I think this is, in this context, wine would have reference to that which is made from the grape, and the other strong drink, or similar drink as the New King James words that, is not talking about being intoxicated. It's a drink that's made from something else. One commentator suggests it may be made from barley, it may be made from honey or some other product. Does that make sense? So you buy whatever and use that in sacrifice to the Lord. Now the last section, 27 to 29, I had separated in previous outlines if you're looking at old outlines, but I think it goes together. What's he saying here? Don't forget the Levites. Remember, they have no portion. So the tithe of every third year, this is not an addition. In other words, this is the tithe you have this year, and this is the tithe you have this year. But every third year, you're going to take that tithe, and what are you going to do with it? Save it so that who has it? The Levites and, verse 29, it's also for the stranger, fatherless, and the widows. Very good. So don't forget the Levites. Make sense? All right. Let's go here, and then we're ready for question number 9. We have time for that. We've got 2-3 minutes, so let's see what we can do. What do we learn about the fear of God? This was question number 8. What do we learn about fear from this context? Verse 4 says, if we fear God, we'll keep His commandments. Let's go from the other direction. If we don't keep His commandments, then we don't fear God. We also learn from that, if we fear God, we'll hold fast to Him. What does it mean to hold fast? Fast doesn't mean, sometimes it can mean speed. Doesn't mean speed here. Stay close. Tight. If something is fast in the ground, a post is fast in the ground, it may have gone slowly in the ground, but it's firm. And so you're firmly connected. You're tight with the Lord. You're glued to the Lord. Can't be moved. Look at verse 11. Fear causes repentance. You're going to fear and make a change. And then verse 23 of chapter 14, we must learn to fear. Does that make sense? All right, question number 9. Time we have left. Practical things you take home with you. Good point. Tithing is not a static thing. The more they were blessed, the more they were to tithe. Good point. Some parallel to that. Say again. All right. Very seriously. You lead people astray, you're going to be killed in the Old Testament. Good lesson. What else? Absolutely. Yeah. The influence of our close family and our close friends influences the most. What else? Good point. Good point. Not every spiritual message is from God.
God wants His people to stand out against those around them.
Good point. Yeah, we need to be distinct and different. Don't act like the rest of the world. They're all shaving their head. It's an idolatrous practice and cutting themselves and boiling the kid in the milk. Don't do it. Now, nobody's doing that around you, but they're doing other things. Don't do what they're doing. Let's get one more and we'll be done. All right, we have responsibility to our family. Even when they sin, we have responsibility. We're going to stop right there on that note. Chapters 15 and 16 next time.